This is an iHeart podcast.
Whatever team Fia is on has a chance to win a championship.
I'm Christina Williams, host of the podcast, In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams. The WNBA playoffs are here, and I've got the inside scoop on everything from key matchups and standout players to the behind-the-scenes moments you won't find anywhere else.
It's really, really hard to be the champions, but we have to remember how it feels and embrace the new challenge that we have.
So listen to In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams, an iHeart Women's Sports production in partnership with Deep Blue Sports and Entertainment on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations, thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ben Ferguson.
And I'm Ted Cruz. Three times a week, we do our podcast, Verdict with Ted Cruz.
Nationwide, we have millions of listeners.
Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we break down the news and bring you behind the scenes, inside the White House, inside the Senate, inside the United States Supreme Court.
And we cover the stories that you're not getting anywhere else.
We arm you with the facts to be able to know and advocate for the truth with your friends and family.
So download Verdict with Ted Cruz now, wherever you get your podcasts.
When I told people I was making a podcast about Benghazi, 9 times out of 10, they called me a masochist, rolled their eyes, or just asked, why?
Benghazi, the truth became a web of lies.
From Prologue Projects and Pushkin Industries, this is Fiasco, Benghazi.
What difference at this point does it make?
Listen to Fiasco, Benghazi on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, Josh Hammer, host of America on Trial with Josh Hammer, filling in tonight for Jesse Kelly on I'm Right. Trump verdict, imminently forthcoming there in New York City. We have never seen anything like this before in the entire history of the public. Mike Davis, founder of Article 3 Project, he'll be with us later to unpack it all. Meanwhile, Joe Biden campaigning today in Philadelphia. Is Pennsylvania in play for Trump? Is it in play for Biden? Very important swing state. Sean Spicer is going to stop by later in the show to break it all through for us. Then later on, what is going on at the southern border? Did we just witness a terrorist attack at the southern border? God forbid. Todd Bensman's going to stop by to break that down for us as well. All of that and more on I'm Right.
I would say, in listening to the charges from the judge, who's, as you know, very conflicted and corrupt because of the confliction, very, very corrupt. Mother Teresa could not beat these charges. These charges are rigged. The whole thing is rigged. It's a disgrace. And I mean that. Mother Teresa could not beat those charges. But we'll see. We'll see how we do. I think the people of this country see that this is a rigged deal. It's a weaponized deal for the Democrats to hit their political opponent.
Mother Teresa could not beat these charges. So says former President Donald Trump. You know, he's probably right. But before we explain why he's probably right about that, why don't we take a step back a little bit and explain at how exactly it is that we have gotten to this point. There are 4 criminal prosecutions currently pending against President Donald Trump. Alvin Bragg, the Soros-funded prosecutor in New York County, New York, he was the first out of the gate. He was the first one to drop his 34-count indictment over a year ago now in April of 2023. Let's take a look at those charges, though. We're going to circle back to what's happening right now in the courtroom. But I think it's important just to set the scene and just do a very brief surveying of the land and a quick rundown of the calendar. Alvin Bragg's 34-count indictment drops 34 misdemeanor charges for New York State fraudulent bookkeeping. Now, that particular charge in New York State, lest I remind you, has a 2-year statute of limitations built into it. What that means is that the actual underlying charge for Alvin Bragg, this Soros-funded prosecutor who literally campaigned for office on an explicit Get Trump platform, yes, he literally did do that, those 34 counts actually told around 2018 or so because of the 2-year statute of limitations. All along, But Alvin Bragg's theory of the case has been, along with Matthew Colangelo, the former third-ranking member in the Joe Biden Department of Justice, who is now moonlighting as Alvin Bragg's, as the Robin to his Batman there in the New York County, New York DA's office. The Bragg Colangelo theory of the case, dare I say also the Judge Juan Merchan theory of the case, because the judge seems to be just in with the prosecution at this point. The theory of the case has been that the way to get around a two-year statute of limitations while simultaneously elevating this misdemeanor offense to a felony, thereby opening up the possibility of putting Donald Trump in literal handcuffs and incarcerating him off in Rikers Island. Their theory has been that the fraudulent bookkeeping charges were actually done in furtherance of something else. Emphasis on dot, 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 something else. Notably, in the indictment last year, when it dropped in April 2023, Alvin Bragg never said what that something else was. And here we are, about to get a verdict in the first ever criminal trial of a former president of the United States, and we still don't know what that something else is. We had closing arguments that took place yesterday, and the debate in general over the past 36 to 48 hours, or really the debate going back for at least a week or two now, has been, what are the jury instructions going to be? How are the jury instructions going to possibly account for the fact that the prosecution to date has not actually told us what their theory of the case is? You know, I've made this point on my daily show here on the First America on Trial so often because it just bears repeating. We are in the uncharted waters, the uncharted territory of a former president of the United States being criminally charged, possibly sent off in handcuffs to Rikers Island. And they literally have not said what the actual predicate offense is. They have not ever bothered to fill in that in furtherance of. They have floated the possibility that it is a New York State campaign finance violation. They have floated the possibility that it is a federal United States Code campaign finance violation, which, by the way, Alvin Bragg, as a New York County, New York local DA, doesn't even have jurisdiction to bring that one. Doesn't have jurisdiction to bring a federal campaign finance law violation. That they have floated the possibility that maybe it is some sort of tax violation. So all along, this jury instruction debate has boiled down to this. Will the jury instructions say what the actual crime is? Will it include what lawyers call the relevant mens rea, the specific intentionality needed, the specific mentality, the specific mental state, the subjective mental state of the criminal defendant? You know, back when I was in law school, back when I was taking criminal law my first year back at the University of Chicago Law School, you learned that every crime has two parts, a mens rea, which is your mentality, and then the actus reus, that's the actual literal act. For example, if you are prosecuting someone for homicide, the way that you can differentiate, among other factors, between manslaughter, first degree murder, and so forth, is what is the mens rea? Was it premeditated in cold blood? Was it a negligent homicide and so forth there? The judge here, Juan Merchan, not only has completely elided any possible consideration of relevant mens rea, the jury instructions go even further than that. In what the always, always exceptional legal commentator Jonathan Turley refers to as a coup de grace, for former President Trump, and I hope and pray that Jonathan Turley is wrong on that. But he said earlier today, and this has been corroborated elsewhere, that the jury instructions include a deliberate omission, a deliberate decision not to fill in what that in furtherance of predicate offense is. Put another way, if the 12 jurors, let's say four of them say that the in furtherance of from the fraudulent bookkeeping is actually in furtherance of a New York State campaign finance law. Let's say that four more say that it is in furtherance of a federal campaign finance law. And then let's say that the final four say that it is in furtherance of a tax evasion. For purposes of a criminal conviction, Judge Merchan is going to treat that as the required unanimity that would mean that Donald Trump is convicted. Guys, the fix is in. This thing has been jury-rigged from the outset. Robert De Niro, the whole Biden campaign apparatus there outside the courtroom yesterday, literally showing to the world what many of us have said for months and months now, which is that this is not a legal proceeding. This is not a criminal trial. This is a politicized lawfare apparatus vehicle that the Democrat lawfare complex, as I call it, is now increasingly forced to put all of their eggs in this particular basket. All the others are collapsing. In Georgia, the Fonnie Willis case, that's not getting the trial before November. In Florida, the classified documents case, Judge Aileen Cannon's been doing a great job of slow walking there. That's not getting to a trial before November in all likelihood either. In Washington, D.C., similarly unlikely. We are now waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to tell us what happens when it comes to the scope and breadth and depth of presidential immunity. So the Democrat lawfare complex is putting all of its eggs into this rotten, fetid New York City basket. And they know it too. That is why they are pulling out all the stunts. That is why the Democrat partisan judge, Juan Merchan, who literally donated to the Joe Biden 2020 campaign, whose daughter, Lauren Merchan, has fundraised up to $93 million for her well-connected, well-heeled Democratic fundraising and political clients based on the fact that her daddy might become the first judge to incarcerate a former president. That is why they have not ceded an inch. Why would they? They're on the one-yard line at this point. Folks, if you are a red-blooded American patriot, if you are a constitutionalist, if you, like me, if you love this country with every fiber of your being, if you proudly wave the flag on July 4th, if you reread Jefferson's eloquent rhetoric in the Declaration, if you love our Constitution, our separation of powers, our federalist structure, our Bill of Rights, all of that, it doesn't matter what your partisan affiliation is. It doesn't actually matter who you hope to be president of the United States this November. If you love this country, you have to be rooting for an acquittal or a hung jury, in this case, the people of the state of New York versus Donald J. Trump. This case is an absolute farce. Some of the other cases maybe could have gone in a different direction. The classified documents case in Florida, okay. If Jack Smith, the special counsel, had prosecuted on a different charge, if he had eschewed an Espionage Act prosecution, had decided to just go with obstruction of justice, he actually might have had a case. He didn't do that, obviously, but he might have had a case. But this case where the jury is deliberating and they don't even know what the actual black letter criminal statute that they are supposed to be assessing and adjudicating is, we have crossed a Rubicon, folks, and it is not a pretty Rubicon at all. Up next, we're talking about all this and more with Mike Davis, the founder of the Article 3 Project. Mike's been all over the airwaves when it comes to the lawfare against Trump. Can't wait to get his reaction. Stay with us. I'm Josh Hammer, once again, filling in for Jesse Kelly on I'm Right.
You're not stuck in your timeshare. You believe you are stuck in your timeshare because these timeshare companies are a bunch of big fat liars. What they do is, I mean, look, what they did to you, they do to everybody. They get you in with the fancy seminar. It looks good. And look at the beach house. And you like it. And I hope you did enjoy it. Right? It can be so much fun. I hope you had a wonderful time, friends, family. But eventually, as they know, everyone's going to move on. You're done with it. Maybe you can't even afford it anymore with the way prices are with everything now. And so you let them know, hey, all right, I'm done. Y'all can have it back. And that's when they drop it on you. Have it back. Oh, sorry. It's yours for life. They don't let you out. Lone Star Transfer will get you out. They will legally and permanently get you out of that timeshare. Make one phone call, but not to the timeshare company. Stop wasting your breath. Call Lone Star Transfer. This family business will set you free. 844-310-2646. Lone Star Transfer.
Time for some more insight on the first ever criminal trial of a former president of the United States. Let's bring on Mike Davis. He's the founder of the Article 3 Project, also happens to be my colleague at the Article 3 Project. Mike, thanks so much for joining us. As we have finished closing arguments, we've gotten the jury instructions now, and now at this point, it's basically just a waiting game. You have been following this, just like me, throughout the entirety of this whole sordid Stalinist affair. What are your thoughts as we currently stand?
My thoughts have not changed. This is a partisan, corrupt, rigged process by this corrupt Democrat Manhattan judge who illegally donated to Trump, to Biden's campaign. He got reprimanded for this several months ago. We just learned his daughter, Lauren Merchan, is raising millions of dollars off of this unprecedented criminal trial of a former and likely future president, requiring Judge Merchan's recusal. He refused to recuse. Instead, he retaliated against Trump, threatened to throw Trump in jail with an unconstitutional, illegal gag order if Trump mentions Laura Merchan or Trump mentions that Soros-funded Manhattan DA brought in this Biden political appointee, Matthew Colangelo, to resurrect this bogus zombie case against Trump. Trump can't talk about Stormy Daniels or Michael Cohen changing their story several times, raising money, trashing Trump online, but Trump can't respond. Cohen is their star witness. He's a serial perjurer, convicted felon. We learned he embezzled from Trump. Both Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen hate Trump. You have this jury pool, this Manhattan jury pool that voted 87% for Joe Biden and Merchan and Colangelo and Brad further rigged the jury selection process by bouncing people who follow Trump on social media, the three people in Manhattan who follow Trump on Truth, but not bouncing people who follow Biden. So you have a rigged jury. And then we saw this Judge Merchan and Bragg and Colangelo further rig this by giving these unconstitutional jury instructions where they don't even have to unanimously find that Trump committed the second crime that Trump supposedly committed in furtherance of this supposed bookkeeping misdemeanor. It's not even a bookkeeping misdemeanor. They don't even have to unanimously agree as a jury what that second crime is. So four people can say it was a federal election crime, four people can say it was a New York election crime, and four people can say it was something else. Again, this is a partisan, corrupt, rigged process against President Trump. This is lawfare and election interference.
Yeah. So, Mike, the point that I made in the opening monologue was that when Alvin Bragg first unveiled this indictment, these 34 counts over a year ago now, one of my very first thoughts, I'm sure one of your very first thoughts was, okay, well, this fraudulent bookkeeping charge has a 2-year statute of limitations that told years ago. When are they actually going to tell us what the predicate offense is? When are they going to tell us what the in furtherance of something else is? And I've been waiting throughout this trial. I've been waiting. When is Bragg, Colangelo, all the rest of these clowns, when are they going to tell us what the actual offense is? And here we are waiting for a verdict, and they literally have not done so. I just find this so unbelievably astounding. And, you know, cards on the table here, I generally tend to be favorable towards the prosecution. In fact, years ago, you and I have been friends for a while now, but I remember that when we first got drinks many years ago, you called me a caveman conservative because of my zeal for all things prosecution and throwing people in jail. And I say that because I, of all people, also am looking at this and saying, what the actual heck? What the actual heck? I mean, is this all that it takes to put a president in jail? So what is your actual prediction? I mean, you and I agree as to what should happen, but putting on your prediction hat, what do you think is going to happen?
I think this is so rigged against President Trump with this corrupt and partisan judge, these partisan prosecutors, and these rigged jury selection and these rigged jury instructions. I think they're going to find Trump guilty for this non-crime of a businessman settling a nuisance claim and putting it in his private books as a legal expense in his private books. I don't know what else you would call it other than a legal expense. I've been a lawyer for nearly 20 years. Apparently, I'm a felon because I've been settling these nuisance claims for business people and businesses for nearly 20 years, and they book it as a legal expense. And somehow booking it in your private books was somehow a bookkeeping misdemeanor related to business books. And somehow booking it in your books in 2017, in your private books, somehow affected the 2016 presidential election. And then somehow that was a felony because you had a presidential candidate conspiring with others to try to win the election. And somehow that's a felony under this legal theory. Apparently, every presidential candidate, every candidate for office in world history is now apparently felons because they tried to conspire to win the election.
All right, so let's assume the worst. Let's assume that what you said is right and that they're going to convict him. I mean, are they going to put him in handcuffs? Are they going to do the whole like Rikers Island orange jumpsuit thing? When is there going to be an appeal? Is there going to be an appeal before the election in November, do we think? It's kind of an expedited timeline for an appeal. I mean, talk us through how this actually looks if the jury does do what you predicted they would.
Well, I would say this. At best, there might be a hung jury, but I don't even think there's going to be a hung jury. But even if there is a hung jury, that just means that this corrupt partisan judge and these partisan prosecutors can just retry Trump immediately and keep him in that courtroom for another 3 months instead of the campaign trail. And so if they do find him guilty and this judge convicts, which I expect the judge to do, he could sentence Trump to prison. Now, there is a federal statute where the Secret Service is bound to protect former presidents for the rest of their lives. And so Judge Marchand is going to have to work with the Secret Service to put President Trump in a prison with his Secret Service detail for the rest of Trump's life, if that's where they're heading with this. But look, this is not going to fly with the American people. And this is where these Biden Democrats don't understand this. Trump's already going to win by like 2 points, according to current polling. If they convict him in New York under these bogus non-crimes, then I think Trump's going to win by like 4 points. If they try to throw Trump in prison, which I think Judge Marchand will do because he is so conflicted and his daughter, Lauren Marchand, is raising millions of dollars off of this unprecedented criminal prosecution that her father is presiding over. If he doesn't do this, he knows that the Biden Democrats are going to cut off Lauren Marchand as their leading campaign consultant and fundraiser, and they're going to throw her to the wolves. And so I think that he may try to put Trump in prison. If he does that, Trump's going to win by like 6 points or more. It's going to be like Nelson Mandela. But even if Trump, even if this judge says, you know, we're not going to put Trump in prison because of the logistics of the Secret Service, we're just going to put him in home confinement, and then he has to report to my New York courthouse once a week or twice a week for drug test and urine test and probation, they're going to try to keep President Trump off the campaign trail for the rest of this year.
Yeah, 100%. And that very much is one of their lead goals all along, as you and I both know. I mean, while Joe Biden is campaigning in Pennsylvania, Donald Trump is confined to this courtroom for the 5 days of the working week. So, Mike, in our remaining time, I want to switch gears a little bit here. Justice Sam Alito, who has been in the leftist crosshairs for a while now for these outrageous, these frankly just absurdly stupid stories about flags that he was flying both in his Virginia home, then his New Jersey beach home. They're very common flags. They say it's an insurrectionist symbol. So he took the step of actually writing a formal letter to Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Durbin and the rest of Senate Democrats explaining why he's not going to recuse. Why don't you go ahead and just break that down for us? What are your thoughts on that?
He's absolutely right. Justice Alito should tell them to go to hell, frankly, because he is required not to recuse. The lower federal courts, the federal judges are interchangeable. And if there's an appearance of bias, you can just swap out another judge. With Supreme Court justices, they're not. There is a presumption that Supreme Court justices do not recuse because you do not want to happen, what the Senate Democrats and other Democrats, the New York Times are doing right now. They're trying to play games right now to get Alito to recuse because he's deciding two January 6th cases, the Trump case on presidential immunity and the Fisher case where the Biden Justice Department used the Enron obstruction of justice statute for corporate fraud to go after Trump and their political enemies, the January 6th defendants. Justice Alito should not recuse. His wife flew an upside-down distress American flag after one of their deranged neighbors had an F Trump sign in front of a school bus, and the neighbor called Mrs. Alito the C-word. They're lucky that Mrs. Alito only flew the upside-down distress flag after that instead of knocking their faces with her fist. And she also flew the appeal to heaven flag, the George Washington Revolutionary War flag that has flown across America for centuries, including by the city of San Francisco. Not exactly MAGA supporters in the city of San Francisco. This is a bogus game that the Democrats are playing. And Jody Cantor at the New York Times is a partisan shill for bringing these bogus stories against Justice Alito. If Justice Alito needs to recuse Jody and Senate Democrats, why hasn't the Biden Justice Department asked for Justice Alito's recusal in the Fisher case and the Trump case? And the answer is they know that request would be legally frivolous and they'd probably get sanctioned.
Well, there you have it. Mike Davis, appreciate your time, brother.
Thank you, Josh.
For more on Lawfare and all things 2024 campaign related, coming up next, we're bringing on Sean Spicer.
Sleep might be the most underrated thing in the world because it changes everything. It changes your entire life, your entire day. Haven't you gone through so many nights where you didn't get a good night's sleep, toss and turn and back hurt? Or even worse, this is what always got me. If you end up taking something to sleep, everything you take to sleep makes you feel like crap the next day. It's awful. You wake up in this fog. You never fully wake up. It's terrible. And then I found Dream Powder. What a name, right? Beam is the name of the company. They're wonderful. And they came up with Dream Powder. It's basically hot chocolate, but it's got all this natural stuff in it, melatonin and whatnot. And I drink it every single night before bed. And I knock out 8-9 hours, just beautiful sleep. But that's not the best part. The best part is the next day when I wake up. I don't wake up in a fog. I wake up feeling like $1 million. Go get some. Shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly.
Under Trump, this kind of government will perish from the earth. I don't mean to scare you. No, wait, maybe I do mean to scare you. If Trump returns to the White House, you can kiss these freedoms goodbye that we all take for granted. And elections, forget about it. That's over. That's done. If he gets in, I can tell you right now, he will never leave. He will never leave. You know that. He will never leave.
Elections, forget about it, says washed-up former A-list actor Robert De Niro. But what says Sean Spicer? Sean Spicer is the host, of course, of The Sean Spicer Show right here on The First TV, Monday through Friday at 7 p.m. Sean, thank you so much for joining us. As you and I both watched this just clown car destruction from Robert De Niro and the Democrat Lawfare complex playing out outside of the courtroom of Justice Juan Merchan in New York City earlier this week. You know, we've talked about the Lawfare already on this show. What are the politics of this? I mean, is this actually going to work out for the Democrats? Seems like kind of a Hail Mary to me.
Oh, it's a huge Hail Mary. You see the guy in the back, by the way, the black gentleman over De Niro's left shoulder. He is the comms director for the Biden campaign. This was clearly, I mean, I cannot believe the level of incompetence. The idea that you would show up, you haven't shown up in, what, 5 weeks, and suddenly you show up on the day of this court hearing and make a big spectacle like this. This was a massive unforced error, and it proved the Trump campaign's point that this is all political by the very nature of the campaign folks showing up. And secondly, by the fact that that you've got the comms director for the campaign standing behind him. So it was really, I frankly, they had tried to keep this notion that it was political out of the dialogue for a while. This just literally gave the campaign on the Trump side the perfect talking point when it needed one desperately, just in terms of the nature and the narrative. So I cannot believe, look, here's my guess on this, by the way. There was a big Politico headline yesterday saying that the Dems were freaking out, their words, not mine, about how this campaign is being run and the concern that a lot of leading Democrats have about the current poll numbers. This just gave further concern to that same group of people. I wouldn't be surprised to see a shakeup at the top levels of the campaign in the next week or two. More likely than not, what I would see is like some kind of babysitter coming in where they say that they're bringing in an old hand, a Rahm Emanuel, if you will. Somebody comes in and says he's going to be the new chairman or something like that. But these guys are making unforced errors at a critical time.
Yeah, no, they're making a ton of unforced errors, and they're making it right out in the open. And they are freaking out, as the Politico article described in luscious and quite vivid detail. And, you know, the Biden campaign is in Philadelphia this week. They're in Pennsylvania while Donald Trump is being confined to this courtroom in New York City. So what is the play there? Are they trying just to gin up black support in Philadelphia? Are they trying to reassure the black demographic? I mean, when they look at the current polls, when they look at the stunts they're pulling, this Hail Mary thing with Robert De Niro, what is their move just to try to get enthusiasm and voter turnout from historically Democratic groups like black voters, millennials, groups like that?
Yeah, it's twofold. The first is that logistically it's easy, right? I mean, this is their go-to. If they need to go somewhere, you go to Pennsylvania. I mean, you see this every week. It's like on the way home for him when he goes to Delaware, to the beach or to his house. So it's logistically easy. Two, it's part of what they call the blue wall, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. They have to win. I mean, I don't see how there's any scenario to get to 270 if you don't win one of those three if you're Biden, right? So that's it. And then look, and then to your point about they know that they are eroding support among black men in particular. You've seen Trump at the end of the last election, he was about 8%. Right now he's polling just north of 20%. That's a concern from them. You think about these urban areas, the states that I just mentioned, Detroit and Michigan, Milwaukee and Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. Just to put this in context to people, the 20 electoral votes in Pennsylvania were won by Trump by 44,292 votes, which is 0.72% of margin in 2016. Biden won Pennsylvania, according to the official record, by 80,555 votes. That's 1.86. This is going to be a close state. And so, as I said, the bottom line is, if you think about that blue wall, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, well, it's just easy, you know, to always be going there because it's 20 electoral votes. That's more than Michigan's 16 and Wisconsin's 10. It's the big prize. And it's just easy for them on a Friday to be like, hey, we're on our way to the beach. Let's swing by Pennsylvania, maybe Philly or Scranton. So that's why they're doing what they're doing. It's a key constituency that they need, and it's an easy swing by logistically.
Well, you know, switching gears a little bit, Sean, but sticking on the same overarching theme of swing states and key demographics and everything like that. I mean, probably the last remaining huge question when it comes to the Republican ticket is who's the other half of that ticket going to be? And, you know, this is that time of the year where politicos like me and you love to talk about the Veep stakes and all of that. Who should it be? And what kind of factors should go into that decision for President Trump?
You know, it's funny you ask that. I did a thing on my show the other day where I put my bet into an envelope and I mailed it to my producer in LA. And we will open that on my show when he does to see if I'm right. But I will tell you this. If I had to give you a list right now, I would say it's probably Tom Cotton, J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio. I still have a problem with Rubio in Florida. I don't know. I hear that people are talking about ways to get around this. But people have to remember that Florida has 30 electoral votes. The Constitution prohibits the vice president and the president both getting them from any given state. So it logistically doesn't make sense. There are talks that potentially Rubio would resign and then move out of state. I think that's too complicated. I think Trump is going to go someone that he feels like he has a relationship with that understands the dynamic, meaning they have to be the Robin to his Batman.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. And to your point as well, as a Floridian myself, I couldn't agree with you more strongly about Marco Rubio. The text of the 12th Amendment is actually, it's actually pretty clear on this one, to be honest with you. They managed to get around it with Bush Cheney in 2000, but Cheney had
Obviously, you know the law really well. And the bottom line is they didn't get around it in 2020, right? I mean, Cheney just sort of knew it and said, great, I'll move back to Wyoming. I still own houses there. But again, it's not just moving. Remember, the state that you move to has to allow you to become a voter quickly. Some states say that you have to be there for months. So in the case of Rubio, he would have to move back and to somewhere and establish residency quick. I get it's possible, but it's just one more dynamic and one more challenge. In the case of Dick Cheney in 2000, he was obviously he'd represented Wyoming in the Congress. They still had land and property there. It made sense and no one was going to challenge it. I would be very concerned about making sure if you're going to make a bold move like that with a Rubio or a Byron Donalds, that you had that thing six ways to Sunday locked down, because the last thing you need is a challenge when it comes to the Electoral College and the 30 electoral votes that Florida would be clearly in the Trump column.
Yeah, no, I strongly agree with you, Sean. And for what it's worth, my own personal two cents is I've been an outspoken advocate for J.D. Vance on those Rust Belt blue wall state grounds. That kind of is basically my argument. But in any event, I guess we'll see. And hopefully you're going to, you know, open up that envelope with your producer and hopefully you'll be correct at the end of the day. But Sean Spicer is the host of the Sean Spicer Show right here on the First TV. Thanks for joining us, Sean.
As always, thank you for having me.
Coming up next, we'll talk with Todd Bensman, one of the absolute best immigration reporters out there. Stay with us.
I love coffee. I love it so much. And you know what does my heart well? It happened to me this morning. I was filling up my little coffee bean thing, and I was out. I thought, oh my gosh, am I out of blackout coffee? And I went and pulled open the freezer, and there's a big bag of blackout coffee beans waiting for me. That was the best. Blackout Coffee is not only incredible coffee, they deliver it to my front door, amazing prices, and most importantly to me is they share my values. Blackout Coffee doesn't do it quietly either. Go look at their freaking merchandise, talking about America and God and guns. How many corporations in this country actually talk about that stuff anymore? Blackout Coffee does. I love them. I always will. It's the only place I get coffee from now. Go to blackoutcoffee.com/Jesse. What that does is it gets you 20% off your first order. blackoutcoffee.com/Jesse. All right?
Camila Montoya Galvez spoke to Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who responded to the accusations of the administration encouraging migrants to come to the U.S.
That is false. If we take a look at migration, not just at our southern border, but in context, the level of migration throughout the hemisphere is unprecedented.
Unprecedented. Do you believe a word that Secretary Mayorkas says? I'm not sure if I do. We'll find out what our guest thinks. So joining us now is the great Todd Bensman. Todd is a fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies and also the author of Overrun, How Joe Biden Unleashed the Greatest Border Crisis in U.S. History. Todd Bensman, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Your work has been absolutely indispensable when it comes to all things immigration and border security related for a very, very long time now. So always love your work. So before we get into this very interesting and eye-opening piece you wrote for the New York Post, why don't we just get your reaction to what we just heard from Secretary Mayorkas? I mean, do you believe anything he's saying there about encouraging legal migration?
Well, I believe the immigrants. I've interviewed thousands of them now over the last 3 years, all over Mexico and Central America, literally thousands. And it doesn't matter what nationality they are or what country or where they're coming from or anything. They always say the same thing, that I am coming now because they're letting us in. And that's it. They're letting us in. They've never let us in like this before. We sold everything we had. We begged, borrowed, stole the money that was necessary to pay smugglers, and we're going in. All our neighbors got in, all our friends got in, all our relatives got in. So I'm always going to default to the primary sources on this, and that's the ones who are making the decisions to spend the money to come. Who said that they would not have come had the border not been wide open, had their odds of being let in and to stay pretty much forever, let's just say it, that they would have stayed home.
Yeah, and you know, your work has obviously helped to shine a bright spotlight on this. It's been a problem for Todd. I mean, Todd's been a problem for about as long as I've been following U.S. politics. I mean, during the Trump administration, I think we started to see a bit of a crackdown when it comes to fraudulent asylees here. But certainly the situation right now under Secretary Mayorkas and President Biden is the worst that you or I have probably ever seen. It's probably the worst in this country's history. But, you know, you also wrote a fascinating piece for the New York Post, a little bit related. This really got a lot of attention and well-deserved attention in social media from what I saw. Your piece for the New York Post basically says that Biden officials are engaged in potentially a cover-up. They're essentially covering up an attempted terror attack committed by illegal aliens here. You know, why don't you give us some detail as to what you found?
On May 3rd, two Jordanian illegal immigrants got in a big box truck, you know, one of those big, Amazon size trucks that's unmarked, though, said that they were Amazon deliverymen when they went to the gate of Quantico, Marine Corps base, also big FBI training facility there, very symbolic as a terror target. And they were put into secondary inspection because they didn't have IDs or anything. And when they were in secondary inspection, they hit the gas and tried to ram through and bust through the cordon there to reach the little village of Quantico just inside the gates. where who knows what they were going to do. It sure looked, I mean, all on its own, it's terrible enough. But one of those Jordanians crossed the border illegally, came in from Mexico. We're not sure exactly when, but not that long ago, and was waved through and rubber stamped in like everybody else. And if this was a terror attack, then that would make this the first attempted terror attack by a border crossing illegal immigrant from the Middle East, came in, accessed the target through the border. The problem is that the Biden administration has now had almost a month of questioning. What was this? Was there a terror motive? That's the big question. Was there a terror motive? Second big question is, what was in the truck? Was the truck itself a weapon? What were they going to, why were they trying to, who does that? Who tries to vehicle ram their way into a heavily guarded military base, if not a terrorist? There's a blackout on information coming from the Biden administration. In my column in the New York Post, you know, we're all left to just speculate at this point, and to conduct analytical assessments. And my analytical assessment is that the way the administration is behaving is all but confirmation that this was a terror attack and that they know it was, and that they can't deny it because they know it to be true and they don't want to be on the record in case it ever they get found out lying, or they know it is and they don't want to say it because Donald Trump will use that like a giant heavy sledgehammer at the very next televised debate. And so the end result is that nobody really knows for sure, but I believe it to be true. And I'll just say that. And I would invite the Washington Post and the New York Times to all come out and fact check me to death on that, please.
Yeah, you know, Todd, it's a wonderful invitation to the Washington Post and New York Times. I'm not sure you're going to find many reporters, tragically, who are going to take you up on that, although they really should. You know, I mean, just a quick word about Quantico for those who maybe are less familiar. I mean, I've been to Quantico, as many Americans have. I was there to see one of my law school buddies actually have his Marine Corps graduation after he finished basic training. This was like 6 years ago or so. It's an iconic American military facility. So it really is exactly the kind of place where you might have some miscreants and some law breakers, people who are frankly up to no good. It is an obvious target for folks who are motivated by that sort of thing. So, Todd, I guess you kind of answered this question already, but I mean, nothing's going to happen here, right? If we're being realistic, I mean, the Biden administration is not going to do anything here. Are they basically just hoping that people are going to forget about your story, forget about this whole conversation, the whole thing is just going to get swept under the rug? Is that basically the legal and the political move here?
I believe so. I believe that they are well aware that the regular legacy media is not interested in this story at all. They've shown no interest. There was a big White House press conference just a few days ago, and Fox News's Ducey was the only one who asked about this. And you can just watch the expressions on the faces of all the other reporters, the disinterest, and nobody followed up on him, on his questions. What do you say about this Quantico base thing? And she was like, you know, that's a law enforcement matter, so we're not going to say anything about that. Well, how about if you, he said, was this a failed terror attack? And she wouldn't say no. She wouldn't say yes. She wouldn't say anything. And nobody else followed her up on it, not followed him up on that question. Like, what, since when would something like this happen at Quantico and the White House press corps not express absolutely no interest except for one guy? So I do believe that they're counting on this sort of complicity of silence on this issue.
So, you know, Chuck Schumer has recently resurrected his Senate border bill after it went down in flames last time they tried it here, and it's probably not going to get a whole lot further this time. I mean, try to look ahead here. For those of us who actually want a secure border, for those of us who, you know, heaven forbid, actually desire to see a country where Jordanians, Middle Easterners, not, you know, basically willing to get to the gates of Quantico and attempt a terrorist attack, do we have any hope for the rest of this year, Todd? Or is our only hope really that Trump prevails and then starts changing some policies come January 2025?
I don't know. Everybody always accuses me of depressing them on that question. And, you know, I can't deny it, but I kind of am with the latter. I think that nothing is going to change here at all until after November. And that goes for the Biden administration, too. The administration has got Mexico doing its dirty work down there to slow some of the flow so that it doesn't look as bad, at least in Texas. They've got the numbers like from 14,000 a day to, you know, 7,000 a day, which seems to be under the threshold of media interest. I think the only way that any of this is going to change is if there's a new occupant of the White House, because, you know, this administration has really made a decision that they are not going to follow any immigration law, nor are they going to use any of the readily available executive authorities that Donald Trump used to shut the whole thing down, like, you know, overnight. They opened up the spigot. They made it so that probably close to 100% of everybody who reaches the southern border is allowed in and to stay in for years, if not forever. That's simply unprecedented that you have that much of a guarantee of entering and staying in this country. I mean, Mayorkas himself recently said, yeah, about 85% of everybody who reaches the border, more than 85% of everybody who reaches the border now, you know, we're stamping them in. That's unprecedented. I mean, if I had those odds at the table games in Vegas, man, I'd have my own tent set up out there looking, you know, and I was waiting for my turn to get at one of those card games.
Yeah, you and me both, brother. But look, Todd, fantastic work as always. You really are one of the indispensable journalists and researchers and investigative reporters out there when it comes to this issue. Thank you for this article in the Post, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up next, it's Lighten the Mood. Well, it's time to lighten the mood, and here is something that I know very much lightened my mood. You know, they say that God has a sense of humor, right? They say that man plans, but God laughs. And every so often you see a clip like this that really just reassures you of that. I mean, you have people there that are supporting this U.S.-recognized foreign terrorist organization, openly clamoring for more jihadism, for more political Islam, for more murderous, barbaric, medieval Islamist savagery, going ahead and burning the flag of our Israeli allies. And you know what? They're going to get burned too. Honestly, personally, when I see this clip, the only thing that I think of is, I'm only upset they didn't get burned even harder. Could have taken a pretty big, bright burn to the face. Maybe that would have been some just comeuppance for you filthy, dirty, terrorist-supporting savages. In the meantime, like I said, you know, you got to look for the little things, right? God shows himself in very mysterious ways. You kind of have to think, maybe that's what's going on here. That's our show, guys. Once again, Josh Hammer, been filling in for Jesse Kelly on I'm Right. My show, America on Trial with Josh Hammer, through the first, available everywhere you get your podcasts. Mike Slater will be with you tomorrow night, once again filling in for Jesse Kelly.
Whatever team Fee is on has a chance to win a championship.
I'm Christina Williams, host of the podcast In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams. The WNBA playoffs are here, and I've got the inside scoop on everything from key matchups and standout players to the behind-the-scenes moments you won't find anywhere else.
It's really, really hard to be the champions, but we have to remember how it feels and embrace the new challenge that we have.
So listen to In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams, an iHeart Women's Sports production in partnership with Deep Blue Sports and Entertainment on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations, thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ben Ferguson.
And I'm Ted Cruz. Three times a week, we do our podcast, Verdict with Ted Cruz.
Nationwide, we have millions of listeners.
Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we break down the news and bring you behind the scenes, inside the White House, inside the Senate, inside the United States Supreme Court.
And we cover the stories that you're not getting anywhere else.
We arm you with the facts to be able to know and advocate for the truth with your friends and family.
So download Verdict with Ted Cruz now, wherever you get your podcasts.
When I told people I was making a podcast about Benghazi, 9 times out of 10, they called me a masochist, rolled their eyes, or just asked, why?
Benghazi, the truth became a web of lies.
From Prologue Projects and Pushkin Industries, this is Fiasco, Benghazi.
What difference at this point does it make?
Listen to Fiasco, Benghazi on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an iHeart podcast.